You're listening to Nick Luck Daily, bringing you the latest news and the best interviews from around the world of horse racing. Brought to you in association with Fitzdares, the world's finest bookmaker, the Racehorse Owners Association, and Thoroughbred Racing Commentary. To celebrate the launch of Nick Luck Daily, Fitzdares have a special sign-up offer that will double your winnings on your first bet up to a £50 stake. Just go to www.fitzdares.com/luck to sign up. Hi there, welcome to the show, bringing you the latest news and sharpest insight from around the world of horse racing every weekday. It is Friday, October the 16th. We are on the eve of British Champions Day at Ascot. It is the richest race day in British racing. And for all that it's been pointed out this week that sometimes it's difficult to really build this up because we don't know exactly who's going to run till quite late on, I don't think you can be too disappointed. We kick off with Stradivarius, and the news today, not only will he run tomorrow, but he will also stay in training next year as he bids to emulate Yates and win 4 Gold Cups at Ascot. Then a surprisingly deep British champion sprint, which may yet decide this year's champion sprinter as Dream of Dreams and Oxted go head to head. Then we've got the Queen Elizabeth II. Palace Pier looks the standout star miler, with Pinatubo now retired. He has the stage to himself, or does he? Could last year's runner-up, The Revenant, give him something to think about? And then Magical. And we'll be speaking to James Willoughby at the end of the programme about the global thoroughbred rankings with Thoroughbred Racing Commentary. At the moment, she's in second place. If she wins the Champion Stakes, she may well knock Enable off her perch at the top. And she is gradually chiselling her way into the hearts of so many race fans. But she's got serious opposition in the British Champion Stakes itself. Jane Mangan joins me this morning. For you, Jane, who is going to be the star or stars of British Champions Day?
Well, Magical is the star attraction. She's the filly that lit up Leopardstown. She's been dancing a lot of dances for the last 3 years. And to me, she's the best horse on show. A lot of people mightn't agree with that. They probably suggest that Palace Pier is, but Palace Pier hasn't run enough to earn that tag, to be perfectly frank. We've seen him 3 times this year. He went in a handicap to Royal Ascot, where he was very good in beating Pinatubo, and then it was a break to Deauville, where on heavy ground he beat Alpine Star. That does not make him better than Magical. That does not make him better than Stradivarius, to be quite frank. And while he's very flashy, he's very good, if you want to be the best, you have to beat the best, and more regularly than he has. I would love to think Palace Pier will stay in training next year, but we obviously haven't had any indicators yet. The way he's been campaigned, to me, he might have a certain fragility about him. That is, again, me speculating. But why else is he being run so sparingly? These are Group 1 races. If he is as classy as he looks, then he should be competitive in all these races. If you want to make a horse, leave a horse be unbeaten, you know, if he's good enough, he'll win. And there's a lot of Group 1s from 7 to a mile that would suit him that he has dodged, to be quite frank. And I think Connections are obviously placing him as they want. And this weekend is his race to lose. I think the QE2 is perfectly set up for him. But Deauville was a disappointing race in hindsight, the way the ground turned out, and essentially most horses didn't operate on it bar himself and Alpine Star. Circus Maximus, etc., all underperformed. So you're taking purely his entire career on one run in the St. James's Palace, where he beat Wichita and Pinatubo. That was a good performance, but you don't earn the price, the title of the best miler in Europe on the basis of one run. Not to me, anyway. If we get to this weekend, he wins the QE2 and Connections decide, oh, we're going to stand him at stud next year, that is going to be so disappointing. And it would be exactly why racing fans cannot latch on to certain flat horses, because you don't see them enough. And it's fine. We'd see the stars. We could follow his progression from the Guineas right through to the Arc. And basically, you race with him every day. No offence to Palace Pier, but he's a very forgettable name because we don't see him. We went from June, having obviously saw him in a handicap at Newcastle and he turned up at Royal Ascot, June to August, with him basically working up the hill in Newmarket, grand, everything's rosy. Turns up in Deauville in August, that's fine. Now we're 2 months later in October, once again racing on soft ground where like it or lump it, like, you often don't get the fairest result. I hope he turns up next year and we see him as an older horse. Give us something that we think he has. I thoroughly believe this horse is awesome, but I cannot say it.
So Jane putting Palace Pier's reputation on the block. No such qualms about the redoubtable Magical, more of whom in a few moments' time. But she faces the foe whom she beat last year. The now pretty consistent Adabe, who's trained by William Haggis. William also will be running One Master in one of the big Group 1 races. And I've been speaking to him about his pair of stable stars, starting with Adabe in the Champion Stakes.
The horse is in great form, Nick. He looks terrific. His weight is good. His work has been good for him, and very happy with his condition.
When you say his work's been good for him, is he just not a particularly demonstrative horse?
He's an idle horse and getting clever. But I took him across to the racecourse about 10 days ago, just not to the racecourse itself, but the gallop that runs parallel with it. And he hadn't been there probably all year. And he really stood out well the last furlong, so I was pretty happy with him.
He's parked out wide in 11 of 11, which can be tricky on the 10 furlong track at Ascot. Does that essentially force your hand?
Well, I have to leave that to Tom, but that's a notoriously awful draw on that particular track, because if anyone's walked it, you run very sharp into the turn, so you either have to go forward or back. So I just have a suspicion by that race they might well be racing off the rail, which I don't know whether that'll be a disadvantage or an advantage, but sometimes they come under the trees on very soft ground from Swindley Bottom. So we'll see. We'll see. I'll leave it to Tom. He'll have a walk round, I'm sure.
Ran a fine race last year. Do you think he's fundamentally a better, stronger horse this time round?
I don't know, he certainly is good. I think he's really well. He's become extremely reliable since we put the cheek pieces on. He really has been good. I think he's better going this way round, right-handed, and his course record form is good. So, you know, the ground's in his favour. I think it's a really, really competitive, strong race. Obviously, I don't think they'll take any prisoners. I think Magical's a good stayer, as we are. So, you know, I can't see anything but Serpentine going a nice, healthy gallop. And that should hopefully help thin them out a bit, although, you know, there's some pretty decent horses here.
Yeah, it's a strong race. It's a deep race. And the sprint is quite a deep race as well. I would argue deeper than last year, when One Master got into a bit of trouble and finished a slightly unlucky second. But she's in cracking form off the back of that win in the Foray last time. You've got Pierre Charles to ride her again. Could she win a Group 1 at 6 tomorrow, do you think?
Well, it's unlikely, because she's never managed. She's only ever won one race over 6 furlongs. But it's so difficult, Nick, because the mile race is a bit too far for her, especially in the conditions, and the 6 furlong race is too short for her. But so what we need is a fast pace, and then they fall away a bit. I think she's drawn near the speed, which is good news. I think most of the speed is either in 9 or double figures, so I think that will help her. And who knows, I mean, she got beaten by a proven muddler last year, but she beat the others. And she's in good form. She seems well, obviously. It's quite late in the day, but she's had a fairly light campaign.
And are you still minded to have a crack at the Breeders' Cup with her if this goes well?
I don't know. I'll talk to Roy and Gretchen, but obviously they are American. It might appeal. She went to Churchill when it was very wet, 2 years ago, I think it was, and she was drawn 1, and I didn't realise what a disadvantage that was. I think Expert Eye won the race, but she finished 5th, but she wasn't beaten far at all, and she ran a very good race. She got stuck on the inside, which was softer than the outside, but she was only beaten by a length and a half into 5th. So I don't think I think a sharp mile around there, if there was cut the ground, would be suitable for her, but it's up to the Jacksons. It'll be her last run. you know, tomorrow will be her last run at the moment. We haven't discussed keeping her, and they've been very proactive in keeping her, but I suspect she'll go to stud this year.
William Haggis there on the chances of a Dabe and One Master in particular. Jane Mangan is still with me. And Jane, William Haggis sounded quite bullish, but confident of another big run from a Dabe, and why not, saying he's become much more reliable. We started this programme by you saying that you thought Magical was the star on show. Are you confident that she will win? It's a tight race on ratings anyway.
Very much so. Lord North is actually the highest rated horse in the Champion Stakes, which is hard to believe. But a Dabe is the next best on a mark of 1-2-2. Obviously, Magical will get the £3 gender allowance, which puts her right in it with her mark of 1-2-1. But I thought she obviously got a tremendously hard race at Leopardstown. And instead of announcing her next move, which could have been the Ark or it could have been Ascot, Connections opted to sit back. And I think the filly has kind of been allowed to tell them or guide them where she's able to go next. So it wasn't until this Tuesday or last Tuesday that Connections actually confirmed her for Ascot, which is unusual for them. They're usually quite transparent and tell us where their horses are being targeted. But this is a really good race. Mishriff, obviously, his French run was very good. Frankie, obviously, staying on board, which is another high-profile story during the week. And Skeletti, I thought, was very good in the pre-dollar as well. But Adeb's consistency as an older horse is very, very likeable. And we saw what he could do in Australia, but he's so versatile coming back on soft ground. And what he did last year, running Magical all the way to the line, it wouldn't surprise me. I think he's something like 10-1, which is an insult to Adeb. Wouldn't surprise me if he went a lot closer.
And Jane, quick word about today's newspaper headliner in the Racing Post anyway, Stradivarius, who will be short odds to win another edition of the long distance race that opens up British Champions Day off the back of his Ark run, which John Gosden described as being like a bicycle velodrome race because it was run at such a slow pace. He is going to get a much more suitable test, but what do you make of the news that he's likely to stay in training again next year with a tilt at a fourth Gold Cup in the offing?
Love it. Bjørn Nielsen is exactly the ambitious kind of owner that this game needs, and who doesn't want to try and replicate what Yates achieved over a decade ago? I think it's awesome, and the fact that the horse is such a character as well just adds to the whole allure.
Well, it's not just about British Champions Day this weekend. There's tremendous action in Australia in particular with the Caulfield Cup and the Everest, of course, Jane.
Yes, obviously the Caulfield Cup, we have a lot of European interest. We have Anthony van Dijk at the top of the weights. Can he go on and replicate his European form, which is at quite a high level this year? I think Anthony van Dijk, he deserves his top rating. But you have Buckhurst in there for Joseph O'Brien. You have Dashing Willoughby in there, and you have True Self down the bottom, the filly for Willie Mullins. So it's a very, very interesting race from a European perspective. It's quite early, 7:15 tomorrow morning. And then, of course, on Sunday, all eyes on Auteuil for their big jump meeting, starring the Grand Steep, which is always a good, entertaining watch.
Anthony van Dijk should hack up in these races down under, shouldn't he?
You know what? I'd like to think so, Nick. I think he's very good, and That obviously goes without saying because he won a Derby, but the fact that he's a small bit of a forgotten horse. He's a Galileo out of Believe and Succeed. Believe and Succeed herself was a Group 1 winning sprinter in Australia, and I really have a funny feeling that the Australian style of racing will suit Anthony van Dijk, because nobody can really say he's a dour mile and a half horse, but he's definitely, to me, quick enough for a mile and a quarter, and that'll probably suit the style of racing down there. But we're going to find out. I think he'll relish quick ground as well.
And more from Jane in a few moments' time. But today the ROA, our supporters at the Racehorse Owners, are launching the Racehorse Relief Fund, a fund of last resort to support the needs of racehorses whose owners are suffering financial hardship as a result of the impact of COVID-19. And I'm joined now by Pip Kirkby and Louise Norman, both of whom have been working on this project on behalf of the ROA. Pip, first of all, just give us a bit of background to this.
So the RRF, the Racehorse Relief Fund, it was initiated back in April by the industry. So very much focused on cross-industry collaboration. And it came out of the initial industry operational plan with an awareness that there was a requirement to develop something to focus on the welfare of the horse, and the development of a fund of last resort evolved, and the principle being that the fund is there to support horses whose owners are suffering financial hardship as a result of COVID, and provide that backup. It's developed and evolved and has grown since April, and the focus has remained very much that the horses remain on a licensed yard, on a licensed premises, so that they stay within racing and within racing's oversight.
Louise, how important has the Racing Foundation been in being able to establish this?
Hugely important. I mean, we've engaged with the Racing Foundation. It's big thanks to them for the fund sort of being supported. And looking at it, you know, this is about the industry welfare of the horse, and having their involvement and support has been huge. And it's part of being on and off the race course. And at this time, you know, in the current sort of with the health pandemic, it's also the global financial crisis impact. And obviously some owners are going to be hit hard financially. And therefore the Racehorse Relief Fund is there to ensure the horse doesn't hit the hard times. And that's been industry collaboration, bringing this together and putting us in a position where we could launch this week.
Pip, given the fact that your survey in April indicated that even at that point, 77 owners were unable to pay training fees and 1,500 horses were possibly at risk of being abandoned, is there a possibility that COVID was masking a deeper underlying problem with the way that we care for and are able to pay for the care of our horses?
I think that survey, fortunately, has failed to materialise, or the impact of the survey has failed to materialise, and actually, interestingly, almost the mark of success of the RRF is that actually there's no take up of it. In an ideal world, Louise and I will sit twiddling our thumbs as no horses enter the fund. Interest has been encouragingly low since we launched it. The feeling is that we had to have something set up ready to go as the pandemic continues to develop and the effects of it continue to develop and evolve. So I don't think so. I think we were conscious of just having something in place, having protection and support in place there.
And Louise, that's very encouraging to hear Pip saying that there hadn't been any take-up of this or very limited take-up of this so far. Just looking further down the line, how confident are you that the sport can withstand many more months of behind closed doors racing in a welfare context?
I think the support of owners throughout the impact of COVID has been amazing. Their resilience and also their continued loyalty to the sport, supporting trainers through continuing to keep their horses in training. And what we've got to see is that, you know, the main aim of the RRF, the Racehorse Relief Fund, is to keep those horses in the yard and to ensure that there's no displacement of horses so that we as an industry can control the future destiny. And also from those horses that need support from a welfare area. This is obviously support for trainers because it keeps the horses in the licensed yards and in the hands of those skilled workforce that look after our horses day in and day out. So at the moment, as we said, there's low uptake, but to have it in place and know that support and industry support is there is hugely important as we see, you know, things evolve and people may become more sort of constrained by that financial impact.
So my thanks to Louise and Pip. Jane Mangan is still with me. Jane, you're somebody who not only comments and commentates on racehorses on a daily basis, you're also someone who owns them, breeds them, keeps them, rides them. So you're perfectly placed to give your thoughts on this.
The Racehorse Relief Fund is something that I think a lot of people can empathise with, and it's a welcome introduction. To be honest, I can remember 2008. I can remember the property crash, and I can remember a lot of trainers, pre-trainers and handlers in this country anyway, going out of business because a lot of flashy owners who blew in with the boom bought racehorses because it was the in vogue fashionable thing to do. And then when the crash came, they were found running and the trainers got left with horses, and a lot of people got, not only did the horses get mistreated, a lot of people got mistreated, and we can't ever let that happen again.
Well, it's Friday, so it's time to check in with the global rankings with our friends at Thoroughbred Racing Commentary. Nothing has changed in the top 10 in the Thoroughbred rankings this week, so we thought we would give you the rundown of global jockeys. TRC have been working on this for several years now. So at 10, this week, unchanged, Pierre Charles Boudot, the arc hero who rides the Revenant in the QE2 at Ascot tomorrow. Down one at 9 is Hong Kong superstar Zach Purton. He looks to have subdued his arch rival Joe Moreira for the time being. At 8, the Kiwi-born Australian rider James McDonald, unchanged at 8. Down one at 7, California-based French superstar Flavien Prat. He's the third of the US jockeys. The second US rider at 6, up 1, is Eclipse award-winning Irad Ortiz. And the leading US-based rider in at 5 is Joel Rosario. At 4, unchanged, is Ryan Moore. Can look forward to riding Magical in the Champion Stakes tomorrow. Down 1 at 3, Gayath rider William Buick. Pinatubo, one of his great allies, has just been retired. At 2, the Japanese-based French-born Christophe Lemaire, up 1. And unchanged, atop the pile, the Italian that has set alight British horse racing for 3 decades. Of course it is, Lanfranco Dettori, as James Willoughby joins us. James, I enjoyed reacquainting myself with that list of top 10 jockeys. It's a very worthy list as well. Anything particularly to note there as regards where these jockeys are based?
Yeah, first a word on what rankings are. This is not just an exercise in playing with numbers, but what a ranking is mathematically is it's that order of merit which leads to the fewest number of so-called ranking violations in future. Now, I'm telling you this so to understand why the jockeys are ordered in the way that they are. Now, ranking violation occurs when a higher-ranked rival is defeated by a lower one next week. In other words, when we get the ranking in a future race wrong. And so what the computer does is to sort out the pile of global jockeys according to their interconnections with one another. So 3 of the top 4 riders in the world are British-based, Frankie Dettori, William Buick, and our long-time number one, who slumped to number 4 only in the last couple of years, mostly through being on the wrong horse, Ryan Moore. And it's because that when they ride against other riders in events like the Breeders' Cup and the Melbourne Cup and the Hong Kong International Series, they tend to be successful. And that is the bedrock of how we know that they deserve to be at the top of the hierarchy. But there are 6 different nations in the top 10. And throughout all our categories of rankings, jockeys, owners, trainers, sires, and horses, we see this rather pleasing heterogeneity amongst the categories, that we see that global racing is very much an environment which features riders and trainers of equal competency arranged in different parts of the world. And it through doing this ranking exercise, we learn so much about the nature of international thoroughbred competition. And from that, I personally, as an individual who's done a lot of the mathematics for this, have learned tremendous respect and a newfound love of racing around the globe, to the point where I want to tune in and watch these jockeys ride. And if you ask me for my personal favourites, not that I ever play favourites, then I think I would name James McDonald and Irad Ortiz as 2 riders I absolutely love watching whenever they ride in Australia and America, respectively.
Well, James McDonald has done remarkably well to get to number 8, given the length of time he had to spend on the sidelines for his ban. Does that mean that, granted normal luck, that in a year's time he'll be right up near the top?
I think so, yeah. Because obviously as a rider goes missing from the results, the system loses confidence, quite rightly so, in his current standing. For a lot of the factors that the math doesn't know about, the human factors obviously, affect the win rate in racers. And the win rate in racers is taken as some sort of affirmation of the jockey's place in the hierarchy. And so James McDonald is suffering a tremendous disadvantage and has still reached number 8. And as you say, I think in terms of pure talent, I think I would place probably only Frankie Dettori above him in terms of the complete understanding, the complete all-round game. I think the best thinker, if you ask me, is Ryan Moore by a country mile. But he's in a kind of precipitous situation at the moment where his retainer, Aidan O'Brien, is fielding consistently 3 horses of very similar merit in many of these races, and he happens to have gotten the wrong one too often. And he suffered rankings-wise as a result of that.
Well, that leads us very neatly onto what might happen on British Champions Day from a rankings perspective, because in at least two of the British Champions Series races, finales, Ryan Moore is on a horse that has a roughly equivalent rating, if not a chance according to the market, as horses trained by Aidan O'Brien in the same ownership. And one of those is Magical, who is up against two stable companions of comparable ratings in the British Champion Stakes herself. Now, this is very significant for the rankings, Magical's participation tomorrow.
Absolutely, yeah. If you look at the horse rankings, which are on the front page of the rankings section of thoroughbredracing.com, you will see that Enabel is narrowly hanging on to her world number one status as a result of her lengthy CV going back a few years. But recency counts for an awful lot when it comes to rankings, for obvious reasons. We're trying to predict the order of finish in future races that are near to hand. And Magical, through her, not the depth of her CV, she's now won 11 group races from 23 tries, but also the recency of it. She's ranked one place above Gayath because she defeated Gayath more recently than he defeated her, which is an important precept to the rankings. But victory for her in the Champion Stakes on Saturday would see her become world number one, which is very significant. We haven't had many different world number ones in our 5 years of operating the system live. And I think when you look at her CV, she's creeping up on us as a horse in Enable's era, in which everybody's aware of Enable's exploits. Magical will, if she wins, will then have won two versions of the English and Irish Champion Stakes, two Tattersall's Gold Cups, a variety of mares races, including the British Champions fillies and mares. So she would then have won three different British champions races. She's developing a CV which you don't need to add much to it, and it's becoming a rival for Enable herself.
So it'll be very interesting to see what happens. In your opinion, what will happen? Do you think she will win?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I think at a mile and a quarter, and particularly with a bit of giving the ground, I think her weakness is that, as a horse, is that she lacks an absolutely sparkling turn of foot. So did Enable as well. But it's her ability really to sustain like really strong fractions in the closing stages of her races that makes her such a difficult mare to beat in a finish. And it looks to me like with the setup of this race, and I think her stablemates might play a role in this, that it's going to be a race which really brings out Magical's best qualities. And I think we'd all, who have a neutral outlook, not from a betting perspective, but we all, from a neutral perspective, a sporting perspective, love to see her win.
Now, there's a couple of very exciting three-year-olds running tomorrow, Palace Pier in the QE2 and Mishriff in the Champion Stakes, who are at 16 and 19, respectively, in the global rankings. How high could they go? What is the highest position they could achieve?
Yeah, I think it depends on Magical. I think if Magical were to flop and one of those two horses were to win their races really impressively, they could perhaps push the upper echelons. It's, at the moment, it's Enable 1, Magical 2, Gaia 3, Contrail, the Japanese superstar, 4, who's going to be running, I think, next week, and then Sotsas, the Arquin, who's retired in 5. So they're vulnerable. That order of merit, the hierarchy right at the top, is vulnerable to a horse improving at this time of year. And I think in terms of talent, both Mishriff and Palace Pier have got it. They've got what it takes. But of the two of them, I think Palace Pier has got the seasoning and conditioning already. He's got the sort of mental outlook of the champion racehorse, which we haven't quite yet seen from Mishriff. But if he takes a big step forward in the Queen Elizabeth II Stakes, he could well make it into the top three, top four. And who knows, a very impressive win could even see him reach the top.
James, thanks so much. See you next week.
Thanks, Nick.
Thanks to James and to all my guests earlier in the programme. Best of luck to William Haggis tomorrow. Best of luck to Jane as she sends you home with a winner.
We'll try to get people a winner before lunchtime. The 12:55 at Leopardstown. A Tad Moody, potentially named after Ger Lyons, potentially named after Jane Mangan in the mornings, has some solid form. Second on debut in a good competitive maiden and then third in listed company on Irish Champions Weekend. I hope this filly by Autad can acquit herself well in the 12:55 at Leopardstown and get us off to a good start.
Right, I better get a move on and publish this episode. That was Friday, October the 16th. Have a great British Champions Day. We'll be back on Monday for all our reflections. Have a wonderful weekend. Bye-bye. Thank you. You've been listening to Nick Luck Daily, brought to you in association with Fitzdares, the Racehorse Owners Association, and Thoroughbred Racing Commentary.